This is Writer's Cast, a podcast about books and authors. I'm your host, David Wilk. Today I'm talking to Willy Blotin. He's the author of a novel. He's written several novels, but the one we're talking about is called The Free. How are you, Willy?
Good. Thanks for having me.
Well, my pleasure. This is an amazing book. Very different from a lot of books that I've been reading lately. You know, a sort of interesting mixture between realist and fantasy. You know, I guess the basic story, we don't want to give away the story, but it's about several characters who I would say are suffering in modern American life. And this is their story. So maybe I could ask you just, you know, what was it? What's the inspiration for this story?
Well, I first thought of it as a distress call to the patron saint of nurses. I'd always wanted to write a book about nurses, but I never really thought I'd ever get the courage to do it. Nurses have always been very nice to me in my life and my family's life, and I have a friend who's a nurse, and so I always wanted to kind of write a tribute before, you know, as I get older, I always want to write that story before I die, you know, that kind of thing. But I never thought I'd get around to it. And then, you know, when the National Guard in Oregon started getting kind of hammered by Iraq and Afghanistan, and I started seeing billboards everywhere for recruiting, but they never once said that you were going to have to go to Afghanistan or Iraq, and I would pass them every day, and I just started thinking of that in terms of healthcare and brain injuries, and how the family always ends up being bearing the brunt of taking care of soldiers coming home with severe injuries. You know, I know the VA and the military, you know, they stabilize them and all that, but really, when a year passes or 2 years passes, the people that really have to advocate are the families. And then also, I was upset because, you know, none of my friends had health care, and there was, you know, my girlfriend couldn't get health insurance, and you know, she's in her 40s. It was bleak when I was thinking about this story. And then I worked as a house painter for years, and one of the clerks at the store I went to maybe 4 days a week had a kid born with severe disabilities. And I could see him just kind of just drowning, and he was drowning in debt. He made no money, and his family was kind of falling apart because of the stress of having to take care of a kid with severe disabilities put on him and his wife. So it was kind of a combination of all those things that finally, you know, I was writing songs because I'm a songwriter as well, about these issues little by little, and then maybe 4 years passed, and then finally I just sat down one night and started writing The Free.
So you know, that's great. It's really good to know. I mean, that these people in the book are real to you. The book starts with this guy, Leroy Kirvan, who's your military guy. He'd been in the National Guard in Iraq, and he's the one with a brain injury. So, but you pick him up kind of after years of being in the dark, literally, from his wound. And when he kind of wakes up, it was sort of shocking to me, you know, that he wakes up and instead of being happy to be conscious, to be aware in the world, he has this revelation that he will, he may not keep that awareness, you know, that it won't last, and that he's kind of afraid of what will happen. So he tries to commit suicide almost on a, you know, instantly kind of, you know, a desperate move, which ends up pretty badly.
Yeah, I mean, one of the ideas of brain injuries or how you know, from everything I've read about them, is that you can't really control your emotions. And I thought, what a horrible thing to send some poor kid. And this is a guy who's not a soldier. He's just an electrician. He was just in the wrong place at the wrong time. He joined the National Guard, you know, because his boss kind of was pressuring him to. So he wasn't in any regard a soldier, and now he's left with a mind that sees, you know, really dark stuff, and he can't control it. And that was the whole idea behind Leroy was, you take this really cool kid who's, you know, like Willie Nelson says, you know, the reason there's so many sad country songs is because we all, 99% of us, have never found the right girl. But Leroy did find the right girl, and he was having a really good run, and he was happy, and then he had the brain injury. And his girlfriend, as well as his mother, have to, you know, pay the price for that and take care of him, and it destroys both of them in a lot of ways. And so my idea with Leroy was the cost that it cost him, as well as his, you know, a really great love affair with his girlfriend, and the cost on his mom. And so what I want to say was, like, when he realized that where he was, and that he'd been in, you know, just a suburban group home in a small town, I mean, it freaked him out. I don't think he knew what was real and what wasn't real. And he thought, if this was a dream and he really saw where he was, then maybe he should just try to get out for good.
Right. Well, it seems like all of your characters in this book, you know, you have Leroy, Freddie, Darla. I mean, all of the people in the book are suffering through difficulties, you know, which you would probably say are circumstantial, not of their own making. You know, they're trying to figure out how to survive and how to be good people. And they're continuously faced with challenges and trying. And what shines through is that they, you know, it's not that they overcome, but that their spirits are so strong despite all of these powerful things working against them. And in the case of Leroy, what's so powerful is he creates this other world, a fantasy world that in his dream, which is where the story, you know, the title of the book comes from, that dream life. But that's how he kind of, I don't want to say again, or he doesn't overcome, but lives through the experience.
Yeah, with him, the fantasy, you know, the idea of the free is two things. It's the national anthem, of course, was the main reason. What I say with the fantasy story was, I wanted it to be both romantic and very violent and scary at the same time, like his emotions, how he would get frustrated, tired, hurt, and scared, and then feel euphoria. All that's mixed with the medication he's been given when he's hurt in the hospital. So he's kind of saying, I think, in his hope was to disappear with his girlfriend in his mind, and hopefully he could just live there forever. His mind's a tricky, damaged thing, and it won't let him. And so he fluctuates from trying to be with her to these, you know, kind of really dark passages where you know, he's getting chased by you know, a vigilante group, really. Also, you know, like with the nurse Pauline and with Freddie, I mean, most people I've ever met have to deal with taking care of a loved one that is either, you know, mentally ill or is getting old, or, you know, every person eventually has to take care of someone in a long-term basis. And you don't really know when you go to a store or you work with somebody, you really don't know, like, the kind of burdens that people are under every day. And I was trying to talk about that. And, you know, a guy going to a paint store is not going to realize that Freddie McCall is drowning in debt and has lost his kids, and one of his kids has a severe disability. But they just see him as a guy that works at a paint store, and they don't think much about it.
No, that's true. But all of your characters are, I mean, all of the main characters who we see as, you know, in these situations, like the nurse, or Freddie, you know, working in the store. I mean, people like them. They're all, despite their sorrows, their difficulties, their challenges, and she's taking care of her father, who is just a disaster and, you know, hard to be with and, you know, has trouble relating to her and seeing her as a human being. But she, you know, everyone that they meet seems to like them, you know, so that all of these characters who are, that you're, you know, that are the people who are in the story, you know, you feel, or you, you show them as being, you know, they're nice. They're nice people. They're just trying to get through all these difficulties.
I mean, I think, you know, people put on brave faces, or at least a lot of people do. As you see with Pauline, she might be a good nurse and be funny and kind of tough. But at home, she's, you know, she's just isolated herself. You know, she grew up being around a, you know, kind of a manic, depressive, you know, mentally ill father. And so she's had to build an endless maze of walls to try to protect herself. And she's in her mid-30s and she lives alone and she doesn't have much of a social life. And I think when we meet her, she's pretty isolated. Maybe a patient, if you were a patient of hers or a friend of yours was a patient of hers, you would never think that. You would think maybe she has this great life because she so holds herself so together. But when we see her by herself, she's always kind of breaking down. She takes it out on, she overeats and watches TV and gets, you know, has a few too many drinks. But she's tough, but she, that's their outer shell. And so I was trying to say that as well. Both Pauline and Freddie, to me, are kind of studies in kindness. I was becoming more and more cynical myself, and I needed to be reminded to be kind. And I think in a lot of ways, Freddie and Pauline reminded me that. And also, I think, you know, I was trying to say they're, in many ways, the most Christian-like, and that they put others before themselves. And they're so kind and charitable. Where the young girl Carol, who Pauline meets, a very right wing family, and they ostracize her for failing and for stumbling. And so does Freddie's boss Pat at the paint store. He's a very right wing born again guy, and he again forgets to be kind, and he wears, both of them wear their religion with boxing gloves, and I was trying to discuss that a little bit in my own way.
Well, you did. I think you succeeded in that. You know, you demonstrate what it is to be really, truly sympathetic to other people, which is what all religions preach. And then you've got, you know, the organized side of religion, which doesn't somehow, isn't able to communicate that in anymore in real ways. So, you know, you did contrast, you know, in both cases, you've got people who are participating in kind of mainstream so-called religion who are, they don't do anything. You know, they don't do anything for anybody else. They just do it for themselves.
Yeah, it's the whole idea of, like, this poor girl who I'm always interested in, and people that are on the fence, meaning that they, with a little help, they could be all right. Now, there's some lost causes, sure, but I think most people, they just need a little, they need somebody to kind of push them towards the light, say, or push them towards trying. And pick them up when they're susceptible to really falling on hard times. You pick them up and you set them straight. Now, granted, some people will just keep messing up, but a lot of people, the majority of people, I think, want to do all right. And so I think when we meet this girl who's run away from home to kind of get under the pressure of her mom, who's suddenly become, you know, a very right-wing born-again Christian, and she can't really stomach it. Or I think navigate it. Her brother leaves before her, and then she becomes this runaway, and she doesn't do very well at it, and she ends up, living on the streets with it weighing over her head with you know, kind of a pack of street boys, and so when Pauline meets her, when the girl ends up in the hospital, and Pauline meets her, the girl's already pretty damaged, and I think her. The mom's continued hatred and ostracizing of her, you know, kind of puts the nails in the coffin for this poor kid. And I think Pauline tries to help, but, you know, she can only help so much. And that's what I was trying to say with we meet her first as Joe, and then we find out her real name's Carol.
Well, and also I'd say with Leroy, in his dream life, he seems to also be one who tries to put other people ahead of him, ahead of himself. You know, that he's always, at least in the dreams, you know, which are, they're kind of inspired by what happens to him in his hospital bed. But he seems also to always be trying to do good. He's rescuing the girl that he's with in this dream story. He's always trying to get to some place where they can be safe, but he sacrifices himself at every turn for her.
Well, it's also a fantasy. That part's like, you're right, I never thought of it that way. I thought of it like it's his fantasy story, you know, and so it's his dream, and he's a science fiction buff, and so I figured he would be the hero, you know, and he would always be looking out for his gal. The sad part for him is that he suddenly gets these great big cliffs of darkness that he falls over every once in a while or gets consumed by. And that's the struggle he has, but you're right. He's always trying to be an all right guy. And I think in real life, he was probably a really, really cool kid.
Yeah. It's sort of, I mean, I did feel kind of sad about a lot of these people that you write about that, you know, it's hard, you know, they're living, you know, these are very tough. You've painted some, you know, pretty tough portraits here.
I think they're just realistic in a lot of ways. I mean, most working class people or most people that don't have a lot of money still have to deal with the loved ones getting old. They have to deal with their children, you know, maybe being born with disabilities or have mental illness, that sort of thing. And people just get up every day and they keep kind of chipping away at it. I think a lot of people are in really tough situations. You know, I was just interested in the characters that are in the fight, you know, that are still fighting like Freddie. I mean, he has to reevaluate what's important to him. He has to reevaluate his station in life, maybe, or his dreams in life. But you know, he does, and that's what I was interested in. Is that a guy like that who works two jobs and is trying to keep contact with his kids who live in a different state, and he's, you know, drowning in debt, and he's going to lose most everything he really cherishes. He keeps kind of fighting and figures out a way to land at least in a pretty safe and a pretty decent spot. And that's always inspiring to me to be or see people like that. So that's what I need to be around. So that's why I write about it.
Right. Well, do you feel like your characters have a political awareness? You know, the context, of course, is that they're suffering, you know, they're working hard and they're suffering, but they don't have control over the larger kind of economic forces that affect them. Do you think how do they feel about that?
Yeah, I mean, that's a good point. You know, I'm really wary of standing on a soapbox too much or having my characters stand on the soapbox too much. I just am not sure about that. You know, in a weird way, at least three of my books have been in weird ways political. But my characters, I just like to have them live life and not have these epiphanies of, you know, damn it, we need healthcare, kind of stand on a soapbox like some of, you know, like in Dubious Battle by Steinbeck is a great one. Or Grapes of Wrath, of course. And he's a huge hero of mine. But I think I just wanted them to live their lives under the way I thought they should without like having these kind of political epiphanies, you know. I guess that's about it.
Well, so for you as a writer, which came first, writing fiction or writing songs?
You know, I started writing songs obsessively, I think, when I was 13. I was you know, I was a really shy kid and had a hard time going to school. And I guess I just always had an edge on me, some kind of weight on my back or something to that effect. And so my brother said I should just, we were both obsessed with music. My brother is 4 years older. And, you know, he was obsessed with rock and roll, and I was too. And so he said I should just write songs every time I get sad. And so, Jesus, I wrote a lot of songs from 13 on, I was obsessed with it. But, you know, I was always a big reader, but I just never done anything, you know. I mean, I wasn't much of a student, even though I loved school. And I tried really hard at it. I wasn't very good at it. And I wasn't great at anything really. And I just lived with my mother and my brother in Reno, Nevada. And we none of us did anything remarkable. So I didn't assume, I could be a writer because I always thought you had to be a great person or a CIA agent or fight in a war, or be brilliant and go to Harvard to write a novel. And it wasn't until I discovered Ray McCarver, a book of his called Where I'm Calling From, which is a collection of his, and that I realized that you could write stories about being a failure, not a dramatic, adventure or failure like Bukowski or something that seems to me almost like a fantasy life too. Carver was writing about guys that were just failing and working normal jobs. And I really identified with him, and through him I found out about guys like Larry Brown, who I admire immensely, and kind of made me realize I could write the kind of stories that I saw every day or that I was going through. And so then I kind of switched gears around 20 and started writing story after story after story after story, and I just never quit.
Oh, it's an amazing, you know, I've always thought about, you know, the difference between short form and long form, and how song is like poetry. You know, songs are short. You tell the whole story in, you know, a pretty small number of words. So the difference between writing songs and writing novels, short stories are even, you know, obviously bigger on the way, but writing a whole novel is a pretty major different undertaking. And so I think it's unusual to have the ability to tell stories in compressed language for song, and at the same time be able to successfully tell a story that's much longer and has more detail and, you know, just incredible complexity.
You know, when I was in high school, I was always trying to write. There was this band I really liked in high school called X, and they had they were like the coolest band ever. And they wrote really great one-liners like "The world's a mess, it's in my kiss," "I must not think bad thoughts,"
right,
"Johnny Hit and Run Pauline," all these great one-liners. And I'd stay up hour after hour trying to come up with those one-liners, and I never could. And so it wasn't until I started writing fiction, to say really at 20 or so, that my songs became these epic folk songs, story songs. And I just gave up on any sort of catchiness or one-liners, and you know I paid the price for that. But you know my short stories I started writing kind of really informed the way I wrote songs. So it shifted the way I wrote songs through a blender and popped it out the other side, and all of a sudden I was writing, you know, 10-minute folk songs that were seriously uncatchy. And it just, and every word was important to me. And then, you know, I've kind of tried to ease back on that over the years. And as far as stories, you know, by the time I was 22, I just wanted to live inside one story for a long time. And so I just started writing novels around 22. And it just is a fan. I'm more of a fan of the novel than the short story. I like to just get inside a story and live in it for a long time. And so, you know, maybe by 22 or 23, I started finishing novels.
So do you find that when you're writing a novel, do you have to stop doing other things? Do you, like, when, as a musician, you have to be on the road a lot, I presume. So doing performances, rehearsing. So, I mean, does the, you know, the solitude that you need to write a novel force you away from music, or do you find a way of balancing those two things?
It is hard. I don't tour as much as I'm a huge fan of this band called the Drive By Truckers, and I'm always following them, and they're always on the road. And I don't think I could ever, and I love that band, but I could never be on the road that much and write. So I'm not on the road as much as like most working musicians, that's for sure. But it is hard, I just got done with a month-long tour, and it's really hard to switch gears because, in a band, you're out every night. I'm drinking beer every night, and then you come home and writing stories. I'm like a monk. And I don't go out. I have to start running again. And, I get up early and I just sit there. And I love the work ethic of writing. It's my favorite thing. I love sitting there by myself day after day after day. But it is really hard to switch gears. And then when you switch gears, you never feel like switching gears back to being in a band. So, yeah, the older I get, the harder it is that way. It takes a hard time. I'm going through that transition thing right now where I'm, no gin and tonics and, in bed by 10 kind of thing. Not quite as ambitious as a boxer or something, but it's my own kind of training boot camp that I have to get my head back into it so I can, work on this book that I'm working on and give it, my best shot.
So you're writing a novel right now?
Yeah, I'm almost done with the draft, but it needs a lot of work. Usually what I do is I can write a first draft in 6-7 months, and I always try to write a first draft of something before The Free came out. I had this other one kind of almost finished, just so in case The Free gets beat up or no one likes it, that I'll have this other one that I like so much that I'm working on. That's just the way I've always done it, just so I keep going. But and I can write them pretty fast, and then I spend a couple years going over it. Like The Free, I rewrote 13 times before I even showed it to anybody, because I was so worried about the different moving parts and the politicalness of it. I grew up in a really really increasingly hardcore right wing family, and so I was a little nervous about the subjects I was talking about just from the way I was raised. I just wanted to get it right. It was the hardest book I ever attempted. And the scariest book for me emotionally, it killed me. And so I was relieved when it came out and I'd sent it on its way. And so now I'm working on this much more easygoing and fun. It's kind of a gift to myself.
Well, I really liked The Free. I thought it was really good. And
thank you.
Very different. I mean, again, as I said, I think at the beginning, just different from what I've been reading and kind of, I like the power of your realistic voice. It's, you're not, there's no self-consciousness about it. It was really very poignant and moving and emotional. There's a lot of emotion in this book. And, I think readers should be prepared. You need to be prepared because there's a lot of pain and suffering, but there's a tremendous amount of goodness throughout.
I mean, this sounds foolish and everything, but, I've always tried to write with blood, to write with all my guts and heart and everything, because that's the only thing I have to offer is a writer. I'm not the greatest stylist in the world or a genius by any stretch of the imagination. But if you write with guts and heart and you try to write honestly from both sides of yourself, like the things you're ashamed of or proud of, and admit the darker sides of yourself, I think that's all I have to offer. And so I always try to do so. That's what my books are always pretty intense. I guess, or people tell me they are. But that's just the way I work,
You feel like you do the same thing with your songwriting? It's all,
The crazy thing is I'm a much darker songwriter, and I don't know why. I've written a handful. I mean, I've written, I don't know, 1,000 songs maybe. I've written a lot of songs, and I've never quit writing songs for whatever, 33 years I've been writing songs. and I probably have 10 love songs, you know, which is kind of pathetic. But I blame it on my brother. See, my brother was a folk singer in high school, and he, whatever girl he was dating, if he was dating a girl, say Bonnie, he would spend all week writing a song about Bonnie. And we lived, he and I lived in the bottom, like in the basement of our house, and the walls were pretty thin. And so I'd hear him practicing all week, and I worshiped my brother, by the way, he'd be practicing the song Bonnie, and he'd write all the lyrics all about her, and then he'd play it for her on Friday night, you know, and then they'd go back to his waterbed. And that was when I was really into like The Jam and X and all these kind of like political, really tough bands. And I was like, I'm never am ever going to write a song just to get a girl. And I marked these words as written in stone. You know, I was like 13, 14. And I got to say, man, that was the stupidest move I ever made, because I kind of stuck to that. And, you know, I never wrote songs that were like easy going that people thought were like danceable. The only time I write like catchy songs is when the guys in my band threaten to break up because we're going broke. And then I'm like, oh yeah, I guess I should write one that people might like, normal people might like, you know?
So you still play with the same people in your original band, Richmond Fontaine?
Yeah. You know, there's been, you know, I think the newest guy's like 11 years. We mostly just added guys. So yeah, it's been the same group. And, you know, we take huge breaks, like year-long breaks, and that's what's kept us going. And then we'll tour, you know, at most, you know, I think at the most we've ever toured is 3 months a year. And then I have another band called The Lines, which is fronted by a woman named Amy Boone. And it's kind of late night, kind of like if Dusty Springfield was depressive and wrote really dark songs. And I write the songs for this band. And so I kind of have two things running right now. And that band just got back from a month-long tour. But yeah, I basically play with the same old people.
Well, it sounds like you have a really interesting life, and I'm very, you know, I'm now a fan of your book, so I got to go out and listen to your music too.
Oh, well, hey, thanks a lot for saying that. Man, it's not a big departure. You know, the Free started as a song called A Letter to the Patron Saint of Nurses, about a guy kind of writing a distress letter to the patron saint of nurses, saying, you know, hey, my girlfriend who's a nurse has fallen apart and I don't know what to do. And then I wrote another song called 43, about a 43-year-old guy who works at a paint store, who's in this version he was started dealing weed in the basement of his house to pay for his mother, who was in, had to be put in a group home. And those, both of those I wrote, I would guess 3 years before I even started The Free. So it was definitely, ideas that took a while to get rolling, but in general, all my novels start as songs, and then the ideas of the songs just don't leave me alone. And then maybe a couple years later, they'll become a novel.
Well, that's great. That is really great to know. Well, Willie, I really enjoyed talking to you. I think we could do it again, and maybe I'll read another one of your books and we can talk another time. It was really,
I would like that.
It was really a pleasure. Thanks so much. This is David Wilk. I've been talking to Willie Vlauten. Hope I'm pronouncing your name right.
Hey, it doesn't matter. You know, even some of my oldest friends, the guys I've known for 30 years, screw up my name. And so, you know, I'd have to be a pretty angry guy to get upset if anyone messes up a name like that.
Well,
so, never worry. You tried it, which is the main thing.
Is it Vlauten?
It's Vlauten, yeah.
All right, good. So I really appreciate talking to you, Willie. And this has been Writer's Cast, a podcast about books and authors. I've been talking to Willie Vlauten about his novel, The Free.
Thanks for having me.